Right, good evening. Thank you for inviting me. It's 10 years since I've done one of these. So very, very quickly, briefly talk in a little bit more detail about how I've got here and what qualifies me to talk about the subject. I'll then give you a little bit of an introduction into Lourdes and what we're faced with. And Lourdes is a project that is not complete. It's a multi-year project. We're 2 years into probably 4 or 5. And some of the stuff I'll be showing you is actually how we've pitched the whole plan to the client that they've signed up to. In order to do that, you need to know a little bit about Voice Alarm. I know some of you here do, but I'm guessing some of you here don't. So I'll briefly explain some of the rules and fun and games we have with Voice Alarm systems, which are obviously involved in all Stadia projects. And then we really go back to the main topic once you have that understanding of how we've done things. So very, very quickly, how I started was, the slide really does note that, in cruise ships, and I was literally just dropped in at the deep end. And suddenly, without going into the whole story, which you can do over a beer sometime, I was suddenly in charge of one, and then subsequently 3 cruise ships and their entire fit-out. And this was having done live sound for many years, but I'd never done an install. And I actually have Richard Vickers, those of you who may have known him, who I went down and saw him when he was at Kelsey Acoustic and said, help, what do I need? And he explained about all the other stuff that I didn't know about, like, you know, racks and cabling and all the fittings and things. I then went on to work at the Dome, which had a number of interesting challenges. We put in 57 sound systems in 10 months, despite what was said, obviously, and we all know about what's happened with the Dome in the press. Technically, it was an interesting project to work on. Lots to learn. There's 2 people here that actually were involved. One of the designers and one of the team are here tonight. We had just about everything. You had the 14 exhibition zones. You had, this was the main arena during the construction. This was it during the central show, which was like a big Cirque du Soleil type show. This tower that built out of nowhere, and our speakers that came out of nowhere, which weren't made of wood. We then had a huge requirement for live events. We were just in the stock we owned. We would have made a fairly respectable rental company with all the equipment we had, just for supporting all the people doing madcap things around the place. We built our own studios, and then there was just rack after rack after rack after rack of equipment. We used, in total, about 1,300 amplifiers, almost all of them multi-channel, and 804 sound webs. So it's the largest network, series of networks that's ever been done. So, and that, I think, really, as a project, gave me the tools to understand how large projects work. And I'll talk about that a little bit at the end. This isn't intended to be a talk about projects. I do a talk about projects if you want to hear that sometime. But just to give you a few pointers, because this is, again, a slightly more technical discussion tonight, and I've got some thoughts on that at the end. In recent years, then did Ascot Racecourse, the rebuild of that. 1,500 loudspeakers. Put that in about 9 months. It's beautiful. If you've not been, I urge you to go. It is. We were moaning about architects earlier, but actually sometimes they do a superb job. One of the main issues there is you can't actually see any speakers, and that's one of the buggers of, you know, some of these places. It's been, you know, trying to hide 1,500 loudspeakers and make it sound good. Then there was Twickenham Stadium, where we didn't do the whole thing. You can see this was actually before the South Stand was built, and we fitted out the new south stand to make it a complete bowl, and then upgraded the whole thing to Voice Alarm compliance and added in about 300 under balcony speakers. It's an unusual stadium in the fact that it has 2 balconies. Most stadiums only have one. And we had about 8 weeks to do that in, which is quite a lot to do. This one was then we were brought down to St Pancras, where there were, I can only describe issues. Large projects have a lot of politics, and we were just brought in because there were problems with the system, and we were invited to sort of come and help troubleshoot what was wrong. There were a variety of consultants and a variety of installers who'd been involved on different bits of it, and new areas opening up. So we were down there for about a year, trying to help sort things out. Again, it's another place, if you've not been, go. English Heritage were crawling all over, and actually I'm glad they have. They've done just a superb job. It is beautiful down there. And of course we have Sir John Betjeman to thank for it being there, because he was one of the people that led the campaign in the 60s, because they were going to knock it down. So that's how I got to where I was. And then about 3 or 4 years ago I was asked to look at Lourdes. And Lourdes is historic in many ways, and I started to look at the sound system. And one of the things that is historic is the sound system. These are the original racks and wiring. And this was a system that had been there for more than 20 years and was completely analog, has had things added onto, ad infinitum, and it was a complete mess. This was the main control for the PA system. Lots of issues. So after discussing things with the client, we had to set out some criteria of how we were going to move forward. And I think I don't need to really go through them. It's all fairly sensible stuff. These are the guidelines that we're going to abide by throughout this process as best we can. It has a number of particular issues. Obviously, any stadium, you're dealing with large crowds. The need to evacuate people, the voice alarm regs and things like that are post-Hillsborough. That I would hope most of you know about the Hillsborough disaster and the tightening up of dealing with crowds. The other problem with this stadium is the fact that it literally backs onto people's back gardens, and they're not poor people's back gardens either. So anything you can do to contain noise pollution would assist, although actually, having had various acousticians down there, and I am not an acoustician, it's the thing the neighbours don't like to hear, but it's actually not the sound system that's causing it, it's the crowds. And it also varies hugely by nationality as well, depending on what match you've got going on there. It's the Australians and the Pakistanis are the noisiest, actually. So I now need to briefly explain, for those of you who don't know, voice alarm. And It's really based on four very simple principles. It's got a cover, it's got to be intelligible. Hasn't got to sound wonderful. It's sort of raspy 0.5, so just intelligible speech is good enough. We try and exceed that for various other reasons, because in a stadium you're normally not just using the voice alarm system for just for speech or an emergency message, you're playing jingles or this, that and the other. Sport is no longer a sport, it's a business, so anything they can do to heighten the entertainment, and obviously at Lourdes we have 2020 matches and things like that. The fundamental one is you must have no single point of failure, and in addition to that you must have various good engineering practice to try and introduce additional resilience into the system. You must be able to monitor any faults. So if something does go wrong, you know it's gone wrong. And so let's say this room suddenly stopped working, its voice alarm system stopped working, you would put extra marshals in or do something like that on a temporary basis. And it has to be easy to use. It's going to get used in an emergency. On the whole, it's used by relatively unskilled people. So it needs to be something that's very accessible. And they're really the four guiding principles behind these types of system. I should go on to add, if you get any two people who deal with voice alarm in a room together, they will disagree about things. I will tell you some things tonight, and other people will go, no, it's not like that, and this, that, and the other. And for reasons I'll explain in a minute. But I don't think anybody would disagree that that's pretty much how things have to be. So one of the most obvious things is you have some redundancy and diversity. So normally you put just four speakers in a room like that, but you feed them from two amplifiers, so if one goes down, you've still got half the speakers working in a room. The coverage isn't quite as good, the level isn't quite as good, but it's still probably enough to get people out. Another one is the issue of protecting the circuit. And what I mean by that is you've got rooms A, B, and C there. If there's a fire in room B, or room 2, I should say, you can still You have ceramic terminals and thermal fuses on each loudspeaker, so the circuit is kept intact, so the people in room 3 can still hear the evacuation message. You don't actually care about the people in room 2. They're either out or dead. I mean, there's nothing you can do with it. The speaker cones will burn through. But it's about protecting the circuit, and that's an important issue. Voice alarm is also being approached in two different directions. You have your traditional voice alarm manufacturers who tend to make products that are compliant with all the regulations out of the box, and they don't sound particularly good because they don't have to. They're just used to delivering speech, although that is changing. And also, they don't perform particularly well. And what I mean by that, I mean that they don't, they're not very good at covering large spaces. There's no voice alarm manufacturer that I'm aware of that creates a voice alarm amplifier above 500 watts. So that isn't going to fill a bowl of a stadium. So the other people approaching this are the pro audio guys. And there's all this gear there that sounds wonderful, but it's a bugger to make compliant. But as I said, both are converging because some of the pro audio boys are much more concerned with compliance these days, and the voice alarm people have raised their game and 24-bit, 48K, all the sort of ticks in the box that we need. But this is an example here of how redundancy works differently. On the left, you have how the pro audio guys do it. So in order to create your redundant circuits, you have duplicate amplifiers for everywhere, so that if one amplifier goes down, the room, you know, a room is still served by another. The way the voice alarm people do it is you have a single hot swap amplifier in a rack that maybe is on a changeover system with 10, 15 other amps, and if one of those amps fails, that one automatically slots in. It still gives you that no single point of failure, but it's just a different route to achieving that, and that's really dictated by the type of equipment you're using. And there are other ways of achieving that redundancy, but they're sort of two good examples. The other thing you have is when you're networking, you need to have two places where you can make the announcement from, because maybe the control room where you make your evac announcement is on fire, so you've got to be able to make it from somewhere else, so there's that redundancy there. And you network between the racks. Now, actually, this drawing is incorrect, because there should be a loop between racks 1 and 3. And it's actually shown, but we've graded out, because if you're using an Ethernet network, they don't like loops, but we would use what's called spanning tree to make sure that if one of the other two links, the other one is instantly enabled, so that, again, you have no single point of failure, if that makes sense. When we get on to the criteria of coverage, the standards set out various rules and guidelines about what you should have. This is some typical stuff. This is out of a British standard of different parts of a hotel and whatever, giving what the likely ambient noise, and therefore in a voice alarm system, you need to get above that ambient noise. And also different bits of the system will have different performance characteristics. Some will have far more variation in level and therefore want us to have the ability to go considerably higher than ambient noise. Some will want better frequency response because maybe they're playing music, things like that. So one will generally try and construct a table of areas of where you, within a stadium, of the performance you want for each area. You don't want to spend too much money making the toilets and the corridors sound wonderful, you know, for example. And also, your coverage is based on a risk assessment as well, where you are deciding on how much that area is in use, how many people are going to be there. So you might say, well, look, that's not used very much, 80% coverage is fine. Other areas, you're going to want 95% coverage. It's always accepted, by the way, that you cannot achieve 100% coverage. And actually, attempting to do so may reduce intelligibility if you're trying to put speakers in every single nook and corner in the place. It would just be impractical. So you sort of put together some basic design guidelines, go through that with the licensing people about how you're trying to approach the design. And this is where you get into the nitty-gritty of this thing. There's all this talk, and especially at the moment with some new standards I'll talk about adherence to the standards. And there's loads to choose from. I can recite several, And there's different types. You have a performance standard. The performance standard will set out things like things should be 0.5 resty, so it's intelligible. Things should be a certain number of dB above ambient, that sort of stuff. You then have codes of practice, which is sort of telling the contractor this is how you should go about doing things. And it's some design guidance as well. These are the ways you should do it. You should use fireproof cabling. You should use redundant cable routes so that if rats bite through one cable route, at least it goes around the other way, that sort of stuff. And those two in particular often include each other's information, and it's quite often contradictory because they're done by different committees at different periods of time. So there's lots of fun with interpreting when you're going to choose what you're going to use. We then also have European, British and international standards. The reason why I said it in that order is that is the order of priority. European standards come first, but if there isn't a European standard for that bit, you then use the British standard, and if there isn't one, then you use the international standard. So you can quite often find that you might use a European performance standard but a British code of practice, for example. And it's really can be quite confusing, and there's plenty of area of debate. The final one you have is, and this is new to us, it's been around for years with the fire industry, new to us, is product standards, which came in 2008 but come into force next year. And they are EN 54, and we'll talk about them in a minute. And the interpretation, I just wanted to give you four examples of where voice alarm is open to interpretation. For a start, when do you need one? If you actually go through the standards, none of them actually set out you need one when a building is like this. Fundamentally, it's down to the safety strategy of their building, the risk assessment. It isn't down to building size. It isn't in particular down to the number of people. It is down to the safety strategy of that building. Now, clearly a stadium is a complex place with loads of people, obvious candidate for a voice alarm system. But, you know, any place where there are large numbers of people could need a voice alarm system, you know, down to quite small numbers. But you will get arguments about when does a place need one, when does it doesn't. And as I said, the standards are, I think, sensibly a bit woolly on that. And part of the reason for these standards existing is to actually encourage people to actually talk about what's best for that building. Another interesting example is fireproof cable. Everybody says, right, you've got to use fireproof cable for your speakers. And the reason why, as I explained earlier, is to protect your circuits. All very sensible. However, if you had a situation where you're using Pro Audio sound system for your loudspeakers, and you had one amp feeding one speaker from a fairly short distance away, then there's no reason to protect that circuit. So you could use a non-fireproof cable there, perhaps. You know, you could argue the fact that you're not actually making that any more robust. Another classic place, though, where fireproof cable isn't used on a voice alarm system is on the gantries of the bowl in the stadium. So the big speakers around the roof, you'll quite often just run socking great big cables to the clusters, because it's based on the principle of the chances of having a fire up in those gantries is extremely limited, and if the gantries are on fire, you've probably got bigger problems to worry about than, you know. So quite often, and I'm not saying every time, but quite often that is risk assessed away, because it's an unnecessary cost. The fireproof cable is exceptionally difficult to work with, especially when you're talking about, you know, 4 mil or 6 mil or even, you know, 10 mil cables to massive clusters in the bowl of a stadium. But you'll still use fireproof for all your back of house areas and things like that. So the risk assessment will be often by area for things like that. Load monitoring is a very interesting one. What the requirements of the standards ask you to do is to check that the circuit is still working. They can't check that each speaker is working. Someone might put a razor blade through the speaker. You wouldn't know that, you know, but you can know that the circuit is there. And there's various methods of doing it. The two main methods are, one is to put DC down the line and then have some kind of end-of-line monitor checking the DC's there and sending a tone back or something like that. And then you just use a blocking capacitor to block it from the speaker. And the other is to use impedance monitoring, where you quite a lot of pro audio amps at the better end, and in fact coming into the medium end offer that. And that's quite often been invented for other purposes. You know, it's not just for voice alarm purposes. They can, Lab Griffin, for example, have this sort of fingerprinting where they've taken in the characteristics of a speaker under load, and then can check that is that speaker performing as they think it should be performing, and things like that. But the problem with both those methods is as soon as you start putting a lot of loudspeakers on a circuit, laws of physics, the variations in impedance or load get almost impossible to measure, certainly with long cable runs. Certainly with this fireproof cable that's got a shield around it that turns a bit of it into a capacitor, and it becomes certainly a bit of a black art. And it's certainly possible to remove loudspeakers from a voice alarm circuit and not have the fault monitoring actually raise it as an issue. So it's an imperfect system. The rail industry, for example, has put a limit on how many loudspeakers you put on one circuit to try and prevent that. But there's nothing in the main VA standards about that, although obviously good engineering practice and good design would mean you wouldn't put, you know, dozens and dozens of speakers, you know, for the reasons I've given. And another classic one is standby time. A voice alarm system has to work even if the power fails. So you need some battery backup. Well, how much do you use? So 5839, BS5839 will say 24 hours. So you have got the ability that the power can go off for 24 hours. And after 24 hours, it's still enough power left into the system to run on load, having run 24 hours quiescently, to run on load to do an evacuation for 30 minutes. EN 54 Part 14 recommends 72 hours, based on the principle of the fact that you might leave the place on a Friday night, come back in Monday morning, and then need to suddenly do an evac, and things like that. Well, you have potentially huge costs there. When I was costing up one stadium to a client, the stadium was about £1 million job, but £80,000 of it was UPSs and batteries. And the client said to me, look, we were up for spending £1 million, we sort of don't mind that, but why is 8% of our money going on UPSs and batteries? You know, I'd rather have shinier loudspeakers or something like that. And it's a problem. Now, a way around it is you can have generators and maintain supplies and things like that, and then you can do a risk assessment to reduce it and things like that. And I won't go into all the detail on that, but it's just I wanted to highlight it as another area of debate, that there is no right answer to the fact of how much standby time you need. And, I'll come back to that in just a minute. And then the one that is in all the press at the moment is EN 54. And the bits that properly come into life next year, EN 54 Part 16, which is really involved fundamentally with the electronics of what we used. So the amplifiers, the processors, the network switches, all that sort of stuff. And then EN 54 Part 24 is the loudspeakers. And what this is required for the first time is previously everything we've ever done with a voice alarm system has been signed off by us. This requires external verification and testing of the equipment. And there's, on my list, only about 10 test houses that are actually doing this testing at the moment. What's interesting with this testing is it doesn't actually fundamentally make voice alarm systems any safer. A lot of it's to do with the NC emissions, it's to do with shaking it about and checking it's built properly and things like that. A lot of those tests are done anyway for sort of UL compliance and things like that. But it's now a requirement, not of these standards, but of the Construction Projects Directive, which is an EU directive. So the standards aren't the things that are enforcing it. The CPD is saying that products must comply with these standards and therefore they have to go through the testing. So it's not actually these standards which came in 2008, it's the CPD that comes in next year that means this is an issue. And it's a problem. Lots of manufacturers are not ready. and a few are, and they're waving flags, you know, saying, well, you can only use our products and all that sort of stuff. And for the most part, they're right, until people catch up. But EN 54, both of those have exemptions and issues as well. And they are, first of all, there's the concept of what's called kit systems. So EN 54 was really based around voice alarm products that were what's called a VACI, a voice alarm control and indicating equipment, that was a box that went on the wall, or a single rack, which is 95% or more of the voice alarm market, these sort of single systems. And they were the ones that they wanted to check were shaken and tested and all okay. A kit system is where you have several racks, or made up of all different manufacturers' equipment, because that's what you need to achieve to do that. Well, there's no way that you could take all those racks, put them on all the shaking equipment in these, you know, 9 tons of it, shake it all about, check it and make it comply, and do that for a specific bespoke project. So kit systems are exempt. Stadia is an obvious example of a kit system, and I would say that's fairly easy to argue. But other areas, what defines a kit system and what doesn't define a kit system, is still very much a matter of debate. And then there's other people saying, even if it's a kit system, all the individual components in it need to be EN 54 Part 16. Well, the standard doesn't actually say that, although some people will argue that. So, again, there's debate. Self-powered loudspeakers are exempt at the moment. So if you're using an amplifier and a conventional loudspeaker, they both will have to comply with Part 16 and 24 accordingly. Using a self-powered loudspeaker, currently, they are specifically excluded from that standard. But it's perfectly acceptable to use a self-powered loudspeaker in a voice alarm system, providing you're following the guiding principles that I explained earlier, and you have fault monitoring and redundancy and all those sort of things. And then there's this lovely phrase, loudspeakers for special applications are exempt. Well, what does special mean? Now, many of us have interpreted that as something like the classic sort of PD horn that's used in a stadium, of which there's only about three people that make something that can fire, you know, sound, you know, hundreds and hundreds of meters, and it's the only thing you can put up in certain areas. And I think people, based on their volume, wouldn't necessarily expect something like that necessarily to go through testing, although a manufacturer might do that. But I can see other people arguing that there are other special applications as well. So, you know, who knows? It's not been clarified, and because we haven't got into having these standards actually working in place yet, we've got to see what comes out. The other one is the issue of code. Self-compiling code, things like that. You have to prove that your signal path, as part of the EN 54 Part 16, is being checked and is solid. Well, if you're using something like a media matrix or a Soundweb or one of these programmable signal processors, theoretically, you have to write your code for that specific thing, then send it off to get tested, and it gets shaken about and ENC'd and whatever, comes back, which costs 5,000 quid and takes 6 months. And then if you move one pixel, hit compile, you'd have to go through that again, which is completely impractical. So some people are saying that those freeform signal processors cannot be used anymore. But there's an annex to the standard that says, oh no, products that are in wide use are exempt. Well, most people interpret things in wide use as being the little drivers that drive the liquid crystal screen on the front of the panel, or maybe Ethernet switches, although some people argue you can't use Ethernet switches because they run Linux. But could you say it's wide use products like Soundwebs and Media Matrix and things like that? So, as I said, still currently open to interpretation. And again, I won't give you my views on which way that should go specifically, but so there's plenty of arguments still to come. Fundamentally, however, it is not about adherence to a standard. Safety systems are signed off locally by the local safety authority. Adherence to a standard, as most standards say on the front, does not get you out of any legal responsibilities. They are purely guidelines. So if a risk assessment is done and it's passed by the local authority and is deemed the best and safest way to get out, then that is actually what's important. That doesn't mean to say you can ignore the standards and just risk assess anything away, but there are certainly times when you can do what's best for the building and therefore specifically not comply, because there may be a good reason not to. Briefly, while we go on, there's talk of some future standards. 7827, which I was on the committee for, was sound systems for sports grounds, which is a sister standard of another code of practice for a more general voice alarm, was due to be out this year. In fact, we finished meeting in committee more than a year ago, but it's still not out, and I'm not quite sure what's holding it up. One of the things I'm quite pleased with there is we've put in, for the first time, an environmental section on how to make these things more environmental. And then there is a committee form for EN 54 Part 32, although the number may change, which will include some form of European code of practice to replace some of the local ones. It will also possibly add in self-powered loudspeakers. It may also define what a special application is. It may also define issues to do with code. So that's, I'm guessing, 2 years away. And let's see what happens there. So that's the sort of primer on voice alarm. So back to the design. We then went off and did a design, and obviously it's changing because we're doing this over several years, but that's sort of fundamentally what we're putting into Lords. Currently, all the racks were in one position, or when we started they were, and in the pavilion. And obviously we wanted to change it to a distributed system on the network. So the end design ends up being 8 racks, of which we've got about half of them in now. They're not all fully loaded, but they're in their nodes, they're on the network. And it's very much the modern way of doing things, rather than running hundreds and hundreds of meters of cable, speaker cable, back to one point. And then it lets you deal with all the local systems more easily. And then it won't surprise you to realise that each rack covers a different part of the site. And indeed the pitch areas as well. We then added in some control screens, which are in. We have 4. We have one which is the main emergency control screen. We then have a duplicate, somewhere completely different. And then we have a commentator and the cricket office making announcements. And then we have a couple of sort of microphone points over the cricket's goal and on the nursery pitch for commentary there as well. And the whole thing fundamentally is controlled from 4 touchscreens. Very, very, very simple. You just click on a zone or number of zones, hit push to talk, and off you go. It really couldn't be simpler. There's a subscreen for which some people have access to for sort of routing odd inputs and outputs, but it's deliberately kept very simple. There's some presets down at the bottom for sort of favourite settings of zones, so major match north, major minor match south, that sort of stuff, so you don't have to individually select all the zones. But I think pretty much you can see that requires about 30 seconds of training. There is a slightly more detailed engineering touchscreen, and this is where we get into the fact that voice alarm systems these days have many, 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 many more zones. The original system was up to about 40 zones in total. We're going to be putting in about 165 or something. Why so many? Well, partly because we've got duplication of circuits, because AB circuiting that wasn't there before. Partly because we're dealing with hospitality areas and all sorts of things like that as separate zones. And partly also because areas like staff areas you'll make as a separate zone, so you can then send them coded warnings without the public hearing and things like that. So there's all those reasons. There's suddenly the granularity of the number of zones, plus the precision we want over the sound. We don't just want one set of speakers pointing at one stand. We probably want loads on different levels and different delays and things like that. So you can see very clearly that the pavilion is an area that's complete. It's actually one of the smaller stands, but it's got sort of 14 zones in it, whereas the ones next door are old and they've still only got two, and they will increase with time. And so we can dig into each of those and adjust delay and level and all manner of things for the engineer. But the engineer is still using a GUI interface to change things. It's still fairly simple. Another part of the criteria was how do we expand this? Because stadia are changing systems all the time. And we've really presented three ways of expanding. One is very clear. You knock down a stand and you build another stand for some reason, and you just put a rack into it and drop it on the network. And, of course, that's the beauty of using networks, is you can just do that as much as you like. The second way is if we were to build something on the back of one stand or something that's covered. So we've got this stand here, and we then build this extra bit on the back, is you can just extend the coverage from an existing rack position. The third way is what happens when you're just messing around within a series of rooms. And a typical example is what happens with boxes. So you have all these hospitality boxes, and they've each got a speaker, and ignore the fact that obviously we'd have duplicates and things like that. Well, what happens if you want to knock two into one and suddenly convert that to a restaurant and have a local input and things like that? Well, the problem with this is, in order to do that, you've got a UPS, you've got a microphone. We then have to run the speakers still to the other rooms, and then we have to put in a separate amplifier, and that microphone has to go back to base, get matrixed out, and back into that room. So it's expensive. You're adding extra battery power to things. You can see that's a real hassle just for the fact that you're converting one small area into an area that requires an iPod input or something like that. So we went back about 150 years, and we've got some fantastic 19th century technology, which was a nice phone call to Mr. Souter. And we discussed what we wanted, because we said, well, can't we double drive the loudspeakers? Have two transformers, one from a local amplifier and one from the main VA amplifier. And we talked about it, and then we thought, oh, no, because the sound from that local amplifier will get induced into the rest of that circuit and that won't work. So we sort of put that one to bed. And then about half an hour later, he phoned me up and said, you can do it, and what's more, I've already made it. And it's broadcast, people would know about this. It's a hybrid transformer. And it cancels things out. So I'll even show you the drawing of it in a minute. So basically what we have now is a nice local amplifier. We've started to introduce this in a couple of areas, double driving those loudspeakers, but it's done in such a way that that local amplifier doesn't induce its sound down the rest of the circuit. That's the circuit for those who want to tear it apart. And all he's done is made special versions for us that cope with loudspeaker level as opposed to whatever broadcast use it was being used for. So it's quite a nice little elegant solution that is incredibly cheap. You can't drive huge amounts of power through it, but we're probably not going to. Obviously, the joy of being networked, we've got radio microphones for use on the pitch. They're controlled from that control screen there, but it gets thrown out to the broadcasters, because that's the lovely thing with audio and networks. You can have audio anywhere you like. I briefly want to talk about the equipment we've used. We've used this new piece of kit called a Vipedia, which is a signal processor made by a company called ASL in Lewis. And they previously have a traditional security voice alarm background. And so this was their first foray into pro audio, so they've upped the quality and it's all 48K and 24-bit. The interesting thing about it is it's the first pro audio product that behaves like a voice alarm product. And what I mean by that is normally, if you're doing this sort of thing with pro audio stuff, you would have two processors within each rack, so if one fails. This one, if it fails, if the processor fails, it still passes audio. So that's what gives you your redundancy. So obviously it's cheaper because you're only paying for one box, not two. But also it's simpler to program because you're not having to program up a relationship between redundant processors all over the place because you know it's still going to work. And we're using, unusually, LabGrip and PLM amplifiers. And these are Turing amplifiers. Why did we use those for an install? And the reason why is we were looking at different amplifiers, and there's a few Pro Audio amplifiers that would do the job, but we'd had some issues with some in the past and wanted to try something else. And actually, early on, we dismissed LabGrippen because their C-series amps, very nice install amps, but didn't have some of the features we wanted, like we wanted to have some processing on board. We wanted to do the output processing there. We wanted them to be networked, and fundamentally, we wanted the load monitoring. And so it was quite interesting. We started then looking at the PLM and phoning up Kungsbacker, where they're made, and saying, look, we're after this, and they say, oh, no, we don't do that. And it's like, you do. Your fingerprint technology, that I mentioned earlier, is load monitoring. And we started pointing out other things to them that made them realize that actually, without them knowing it, they'd built quite a good voice alarm amplifier. So they modified some of the software, and ASL and LabGrippen spent a lot of time also working together so that the Vipedia talks to the amplifiers in a highly integrated way. Normally, you might get a bit of load monitoring, you might be able to send network audio. All the important parameters on the PLM are actually controlled from the Vipedia. The user doesn't know whether they're changing a Vipedia parameter or a PLM parameter because they don't need to. They spent a lot of time and effort integrating it. And the beauty of this is that the wiring is really, really, really simple. In each rack, you just have a bunch of amplifiers and they only have two cables that go to them. You have just the network, the audio network, which also contains all the control data and monitoring data, and you have just a redundant analog loop in-out as the backup. That's it. Obviously, your speaker outputs as well. So the wiring of it is very simple, makes it quicker, makes it neater, makes swap-outs more easy, that sort of stuff. So we're quite pleased with the fact that we've been able to strip out some of the complexity. The network is Dante. Again, it's a whole other talk that maybe you've had about all the different networking standards there are available. Why do we like Dante? We liked it because it's a true IP network. There's other networks that use Ethernet, but this is a proper IP-based network. And it was quick to set up. We put it at Twickenham, and we had about 130 channels of amplification there. And we just brought along a development card at the time, a Dante development card, to sort of just set up all the outputs, the output of that to go to all the inputs of all the PLMs, as I said, about 130 channels. And it took 8 minutes. If you were doing that with CobraNet or something like that, and there's things with bundles and whatever, probably be about a day and a half of messing around. I mean, it really was that quick. And there's nothing wrong with CobraNet, but it's just old, you know, and it doesn't offer those facilities that a more modern network standard does. It's also very low latency, although, to be honest, that isn't a huge issue for Stadio. I mean, I wouldn't care, actually, in the Stadio network if my latency was 5 or 6 milliseconds. I mean, it wouldn't matter, but actually it's in the hundreds of microseconds. The other thing that makes it interesting is they have this thing called Dante Virtual Sound System. This is actually a screenshot from my laptop, and it's a software driver. So you don't have to have hardware to drive into this audio network, whereas if you're using EtherSound or CobraNet, you actually have to buy the piece of hardware, which is how they make their money to do that. So this is a network that crosses the bridge between everybody else's gear and this little closed world of Pro Audio. So obviously a laptop can drive into the network. So actually some of our paging systems that we've got at Lords, the paging stations, are just a bog standard with PC with this Dante software on. There's no extra processor, there's no extra hardware. It's a 500 quid PC. It could be a 300 quid PC. So I think that opens up a whole load of possibilities to the fact that if you have things like video servers that are embedded PCs, or throw the driver on, then it's coming out with networked audio. So that's why I think there's an opportunity for this and probably after AVB, which is, there's a whole debate about how quickly that will come, to where you'll finally have audio networks, professional audio networks, actually being able to be able to talk to by other pieces of kit. And it works. And I've been dealing with networks now for 12 years, and it's cost me or the projects I've worked on a lot of money dealing with all the issues with networks, and everybody says their networks are wonderful and they fall over. And don't get me wrong, Dante is not without its problems, but what's impressed me about them is everything they've told me has turned out to be true. And that is rare to find that in professional audio. So long may that continue. So, and again, we may choose another network standard for another project. We're not stuck on Dante. But as I said, it's worked well for Twickenham and it's, for Lords, and it's something we we'll plan to stick with there. Brief mention about the loudspeakers. Not the best of photographs, but you hopefully can't really see them very well. I mean, aesthetics is a huge problem. We've done the Pavilion, which is 200 years old, steeped in history, and you don't really notice them. I mean, you can just see them at the top there. And we've actually got dozens of speakers there. It's a very high-Q system there. Lots of speakers just doing very little work. And the reason why is we didn't want to have any big speakers for reasons of aesthetics, but also we were trying to, and the way I explain it to the client is imagine throwing a stone into a pond. Well, I want to throw lots of small pebbles into a pond, and that will help with noise pollution and all those sort of things. So we went with them because they're not one of the big brands. We could have used one of the big brands. They just worked harder to get the work. I think, the performance criteria we need, yes, it's good, but it doesn't have to be amazing. It's not like I could stand in a meeting and go, well, only this product will do. You know, the sonic performance is more than good enough. They work hard to get the work. They help with some of the modelling. They give lots of advice. It's competitively priced. That's what we use. So, on another project, we'll probably use something else. But, there's lots of good reasons, providing, something is of a reasonable standard, not to necessarily use one of the big brands anymore. And briefly, in summary, I hinted at the beginning that I wanted to talk about some of the issues to do with the fact that, yes, I'm a sound engineer, but actually I deal, when I do this kind of work, with large projects, and I come at them from a project management viewpoint. And so even though it's very interesting, and hopefully we can have some good Q&A in a minute about all the technicalities of why certain things have been chosen and why they've not been chosen, I don't actually care too much about that. You know, we have a completely state-of-the-art system there using the latest networking technology and things like that. But actually, large projects are about following a process. And that process is everything from dealing with the politics with the client, dealing with the budget, normally dealing with countless vested interests. I mean, I've had to meet this, that, and the other committee. I've had to meet local residents. I've had to meet the council. And all those views have got to be accommodated, but also done in a diplomatic way. And every large project is different. They all have their politics. And fundamentally, to manage the risk, install projects, and especially large ones, are fundamentally all about risk. And again, that's a whole other discussion, and you can discuss why things didn't go so well at Wembley and how you can actually deconstruct that into how the risk was handled and how the contracts were handled into how risk was handled elsewhere. Now, on this occasion, I'm working for an installer who's, let me run this project for them. So my responsibility is protect them from going bust, because if you have liquidated damages, the cost of that, Wembley's liquidated damages were £250,000 a week. Well, there's no audio company that could sustain that. And okay, for smaller companies like audio companies, they're capped and limited, but it would still be crippling. And there's the other basic risks as well, such as safety. Doing stadia, you're quite often working at height, you're working on a construction site, you're working around other people. All those problems and issues. It's very, very easy when you're installing hundreds and hundreds of loudspeakers and kilometres of cable to mess up your estimates of labour. Most of the speakers you're installing are small. The biggest cost of the loudspeaker is the cost of installing it. And if you mess that up, you're suddenly out of profit. So protecting that. And also you're protecting the client's risk. The client has a risk. If they don't have a sound system, and if it's not signed off and compliant with all the standards, they haven't got a venue, which means they haven't got a business. And to me, those issues are actually more important than the niceties of what particular technology. We could have still put an analog system in, it would have been fine. I wouldn't have in a month of Sundays, but we could have. Yes, I think we've done a couple of nice, clever things here, but to me, that's not the important bit. It was the 2 years of discussion before we even did any work. It's the ongoing discussions that we have each year as we plan each bit. And I know, and maybe he wants to speak, Tim's doing the same thing down at another prestigious venue in London, and it's all that that's actually the real challenge. And when I was highlighting some of the work I've done on projects, actually tend to get them in rather quickly. You don't let them drag out. You tend to try and actually get the physical work bit done bloody fast, because that's really expensive if it starts to extend. And I wanted to leave you on the subject of project management with two guiding principles that I work to. And it's almost sort of leaving things on a downer, which isn't the intention. One is by the construction director for the Olympic Delivery Authority, who I was lucky to work with on his last project before he did the Olympics. And this is his view. And again, you can argue, certainly on big prestigious projects like the Dome, that people lose a sense of reality of where things are meant to be and don't actually go, well, look, this is what we're trying to do. We're actually trying to have a nice day out for the public here. My one is a little bit more practical, but I would like to end my career with all that. I don't want to finish. I want to finish my career with no one getting hurt. I want the client to be happy, and hopefully the installer I've worked with is still in business. Yes, they should make some money as well, and good money. But actually, as long as they've survived a big project, that's actually not bad anyway. And so. They're not very great ambitions, but I think having sort of very sort of low opinion and some sort of relatively low ambitions, I think, is a good way to look at these last projects. And I think that then gives you the vehicle to actually then start looking at the more interesting stuff, as I hope that we've done at Lord's. So there we go.
Questions, if anybody would care to ask anything.
You talked about the Lord's project being over a number of years. Did you encounter any particular problems when you're having to have a mixed economy of your new kit and the old legacy kit from the 80s?
Yes, absolutely. And it's, again, one of the things in the voice alarm standards. We had to go about things in a particular way. We had to replace the original racks with sort of 21st century compliant equipment driving old circuits of speakers. You're allowed to inherit an old system and drive that, but any new bits have to be compliant with the new standards. So at the moment we have a mixture of standards, so to speak. Yeah, exactly that. So there's quite a lot of thought into making that work. Standards are not retrospective.
Hello. I expect the answer to this question to be one of diplomacy, but if it really is that much more risky to use a small company rather than a big one to deliver a product for a very large installation, then why use a small company?
For product supply?
Yes.
It depends. I've been in both situations. I mean, for example, when we did Dome, it was, you know, you were going around and asking people what their manufacturing capacity was because, you know, we were buying up months of production and that was an important criteria. Can you actually make them all in time? I think it depends. I did another Stadia that will remain nameless where the amplifiers did not work. It was over £100,000 worth of amplifiers and they didn't work. I'm not saying they didn't work at all. Sound came out of them, but a fundamental feature that we needed didn't work. And luckily, we bought them from one of the big conglomerates, so actually we could go back to them and deal with that. And it cost a six-figure sum to fix and solve. So in many ways, there was a bit of me that was glad that you know, we had the fact that it was a conglomerate there. But it's a question of what you mean by small. I mean, ASL isn't small. It's the largest manufacturer of voice alarm equipment in the country.
Well, you're talking about the... I think you used the DAS speakers as an example.
Massive.
Is it?
Just not in the UK.
It's not.
You go to South America, they're everywhere. They're huge. They have a sprawling factory in Valencia. I mean, it's they have the biggest and best demo room I've ever seen. You could put 800 people in their speaker demo room.
Very well. That probably invalidates my question.
Yeah.
This isn't my area of the industry.
But they're not a big name in the UK, which is partly why they're so keen. So, you know, it's good for them to do that, because obviously they'd like to make more of a splash there. Using small companies, I've no objection to it, and no issue, as long as I'm confident they'll deliver. Yes. And you always have a plan B. You know, you know, no matter what, you have to have a plan B in case
manage
people
the risk.
And people don't. Yeah, manage the risk at the end of the day. Yeah.
Thank you.